Have we a count of prisoners?
We haven't made the final count, sir.
I bring a message from your master, Marcus Licinius Crassus, commander of Italy. By command of his most merciful excellency, your lives are to be spared. Slaves you were, and slaves you remain. But the terrible penalty of crucifixion has been set aside on the single condition that you identify the body or the living person of the slave called Spartacus.
I'm Spartacus!
I'm Spartacus!
I'm Spartacus! I'm Spartacus! I'm Spartacus!
I'm Spartacus!
I'm Spartacus!
I'm Spartacus!
I'm Spartacus!
I'm Spartacus!
Greetings once again to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment. To my friends, students, and allies, known and unknown, scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen, this is your navigator, John Lash, recording on January 1st, 2014. This is Nav Briefing 100, and the title is The Look of the Anthropos. To lead into this briefing, I featured a little audio from a clip of the film Spartacus, which came out in 1960, directed by Stanley Kubrick, by the way. And this is the famous scene toward the end of the movie when the slave rebellion has been defeated and the leader of the Roman legions offers them their lives if they will turn over Spartacus, either dead or alive. The clip shows Kirk Douglas, who plays the character of Spartacus, reflecting for a moment on the gravity of the proposition that they would all die by crucifixion were he not to give himself up. And he stands to do so. But immediately as he does, the slave beside him stands, and before the Kirk Douglas character can speak, the other slave declares himself to be Spartacus, and then everyone among the ranks of the slaves declare themselves to be that same person. Very famous and memorable scene from that film, which is historically accurate in many ways. You would expect it to be so, as Stanley Kubrick had a role in the film, although he was called in to be director in development of the film. He himself did not independently create the film, as he did with almost all of his other movies. Historically accurate, cinematographically glorious. Each scene like a tableau, like a painting. And following this scene, toward the end of the film, there is another one that shows countless hundreds of men crucified on posts which have been erected along the Appian Way leading to Rome. Of course, I would add an historical note, which I've already added. You can find it in, not in his image. The practice of crucifixion as a form of torture and murder was introduced by the Jews against those pagans in Canaan and other lands of Palestine who worshiped trees. Such pagan tree worshippers were commonly known as tree shamans. The tradition of arboreal or tree shamanism was pandemic throughout ancient Europe and the Middle East and even into the Ural Mountains and into Scandinavia. For instance, Woden, who hung for 9 days and 9 nights on the sacred tree of Yggdrasil, was a tree shaman. Shamans hung in trees, they divined in trees, and they climbed in trees and embraced the trees as an act of love and dedication to the various tree goddesses. And this was a common practice in Palestine in pre-Christian times. But when the monotheistic cult of Yahweh rose to power, these pagan tree worshippers were considered to be demonic, and they were condemned to death for worshipping the forces of nature. And so, in a parody of the reverential and amatory act of hanging in a tree, shamans were hung in trees, and that was the first crucifixion, followed by the more expedient method of merely hanging them on posts. Well, what goes around comes around. So it's not surprising when St. Paul hijacked the Zadokite religion and fabulated his Messiah. The fate of that Messiah is connected to the fate of those pagan shamans of Canaan, or I should say, portrayed in the same manner. So the torturous act of crucifixion is endemic to the imagination of the Jews who originated the custom and was transmitted pandemically to the imagination of the Christians. And so perverted, twisted, sick, masochistic, and sadomasochistic is this complex that millions of Christians today wear the crucifix, the image of a tortured man, to represent a divine act of love and redemption. I'd say even Lady Gaga has yet to top that act. Well, regarding the historical accuracy of Spartacus, I would add another note. Although it may have occurred as depicted with the mass crucifixion of the survivors of the slave revolt led by Spartacus along the road to Rome, there are accounts from ancient times of mass crucifixions of Jews as well. And some of those crucifixion of Jews were conducted by other Jews. And when you read into the gory and gruesome history behind the Dead Sea Scrolls, you will find, for instance, that there were occasions when the Jewish kings of the Middle East found it to be in their political interest to crucify large numbers of other Jews publicly. Why did they do that? Because some of the political kings like Herod and Alexander Janneus were threatened by the destabilization of the Jewish kingdom, in quotes, in Palestine. And they did not want their game to be spoiled by the zealots. However, the Zadokites hid among ordinary people. And if you had asked a bunch of people in a Jewish village of that time, in a Hebrew village, if you had said, "We will spare all of you if the Zadokite culprit hiding in your midst stands up and identifies himself," well, it wouldn't have been a Spartacus moment. No one would have stood up. And consequently, the whole community would have been slaughtered to eliminate the one or two zealots who are hiding among the fold. So if you go back and take a look at that crucifixion scene from Spartacus, bear in mind that it happened numerous times that Jews were crucified in that way by their own people as well as by the Romans. And the reason for that was always the same. In order to eliminate those Zadokite fanatics who were hiding among the Jewish community, the Hebrew community of those days, and would not under any circumstances identify themselves to save the lives of others. Now I've pointed out, and not in his image, that the image of the crucifix, the tortured man on the cross, which is itself a torture instrument, serves a dual role in the tormented imagination of Judeo-Christian faith. On the one hand, it presents the icon of redemption, otherworldly redemption, the Savior, the Son of God, the superhuman agency who comes into the human world to redeem humanity from its failings. But at the same time, that male figure hung on the cross is taken to be the ideal representative of humanity. Rudolf Steiner called the figure of Jesus Christ the representative of mankind, in quotes. So as I pointed out, in Not in His Image, the crucified Savior is not only a superhuman agency of redemption, but also the ideal image of humanity, and still is today, of course. It is impossible to calculate the number of people upon this planet belonging to the Catholic faith and other faiths who look upon Jesus Christ as an ideal specimen of humanity, as someone who has realized true humanity and therefore represents a standard of humanity to which each and every one of us may aspire. And there are even many non-Christians and atheists and agnostics who regard Jesus in the same way, whether or not they associate him with the crucifixion cameo. According to the accepted historical narrative, Spartacus died in 71 BC at a place called Petelia in Italy. And it may be presumed then that the Spartacus moment occurred just before his death. Now speaking to you on the first day of the year 2014, over 2,100 years later, I wonder if there could be something equivalent to the Spartacus moment on this planet. But I would call it the Anthropos moment. If you look on the NAV briefing page, you'll see that I posted a photograph in anticipation of NAV briefing 100. The photograph marks the division between 2013 and 2014. It also indicates the moment of our entrance into the last 3 months of the GNE. These 3 months, or 108 days, are equivalent to the 10th second, the 10th and final second of the initialization of correction, the reset. It takes the Aeon Sophia 10 seconds to reset this experiment, and then we proceed for the next 200 years to live out in some way or other the conditions of the reset. Of course, I use here the royal we, which is really not appropriate. I should say, you live out the conditions of the reset. You, hearing my words, and I, speaking those words, live out the reset in the conditions of correction. And we do that by standing up and being counted like the slaves in the Spartacus moment, although we stand up and be counted not as slaves, but as free women and men. So is the moment of freedom at hand? Is the moment for the liberation of humanity at hand? Is the end of the nightmare of the psychopathic controllers and the sinister agenda of humanity at hand in 2014? Look at the face of the child. There's your portal to the future. What is an Anthropos moment, my friends? Well, I had one not too long ago. I think it was November, when I stopped by the gasolinera, which is the Spanish word for a gas station, up in the little mountain village town close to where I live. And because that mountain village town, which has a population of about 2,200 souls, consists of about 10% British, British papers can often be found on the counter of the gasolinera. So I walked in to pay for some gas I bought. I didn't buy a bottle of champagne on that particular day, although it is remarkable that you can buy good champagne in the gas station in this white village. And I looked down and I saw that face, and I read what it says in the newspaper print right above that face. Go click on the image. Bring up the enlarged photo and read it for yourself. Thousands ask if Mystery Girl is theirs. Look at that face and ask yourself, is that my child? I don't even have children. It doesn't matter if you have them or not. Ask the question anyway. Thousands ask if Mystery Girl is theirs. So what do I mean by an Anthropos moment? The Anthropos moment is what happens when everyone in the crowd looking at this photograph stands up and says, yes, the Mystery Girl is mine. They all stand up and say, she is mine. Just like all the slaves stood up and said, I am Spartacus. Now that would be an Anthropos moment. But how could such a moment come about? Consider all the racial, ethnic, and linguistic differences that separate people on this planet. Consider those racial, ethnic, and linguistic differences as a series of filters, as if they were lenses, multiple lenses, attached to a pair of Google glasses that you're wearing. You would have to take off the Google glasses to see the child as Anthropos. And yet, any child can be seen in that manner. Any child. Some of you may know the Anthropos altar in the Turton's humble palace here in Andalusia. It's a beautiful pastel rendering of a photograph of an Aboriginal child. You can't tell if that Aboriginal child is male or female. The photograph in that British paper could have been a Filipino child from Africa, from somewhere in remote Siberia, Chinese, Japanese, Norwegian, American Indian, Navajo, Hopi, a round-faced child from the Amazon with a complexion of nutmeg, a Tahitian child. Pick any color you like, any shade of skin. It's only the filters on the Google glasses that create those effects. Those eyes looking at you from any of those faces are the eyes of the Anthropos. But are they really? Are they really? You know, I've said that the mere fact of being born as a human animal does not mean that you carry humanity. I've said that, haven't I? It's a brutal thing to say. But I hold it to be brutally true. I invite you to listen closely and carefully as I speak carefully about this statement in this briefing. It's my intention now to bring careful scrutiny to that which I myself have said. And it's my intention to apply myself to the best of my ability to bring some excruciating Gnostic nuances to the observation of that statement, to the examination of that statement. Let's recall that Black Jaguar turns and descends in the empty space of the zodiac. This is one of the granular details of the 3 years of reset. Many, many years ago, when I was developing the astrology of the real sky zodiac, that is to say, of the 13 visible constellations, I took careful note of the empty space. That is a region equivalent to about 13 degrees from the composite stars of the Archer to the composite stars of the Goatfish. The way to visualize this empty space is to picture the Goatfish gazing down into a region that is relatively starless. So the Goatfish gazes down into the empty space. During those years when I was developing star-based astrology in close correlation with tropical or conventional astrology, I had to come up with the interpretations for the entire realm of the constellations. And of course, how did I do that? Well, to a certain extent, I simply drew upon what is called sidereal mythology or constellational mythology, which is a medium that exists. It's a genre. But of course, I did not find traditional or received material on that part of the zodiac where there are no constellations. It's not the only gap in the zodiac, by the way, but it is certainly the most remarkable and unmissable one. So due to biographical studies, that is to say, looking at people who were born with planets in the empty space, and looking at the case studies of my clients over many years, I came to the conclusion, if you want to call it that, I came to an interpretation, a standard interpretation for the empty space. I connected it with the theme, the loss of humanity. So as I described recently, Venus makes her retrograde turn in the empty space at the beginning of the year 2014. This theme or motif, the loss of humanity, comes forward in the final second of reset. Now I invite you to look at this motif, the loss of humanity, from two directions. Look at it from the direction where you observe those human beings who have lost their humanity, such as Hillary Clinton or Madeleine Albright, to pick two easy examples, Barack Obama, certainly. You are looking out from your eyes at human beings who have lost their humanity. Now, assume the other angle. Look into yourself to see if you have lost your humanity. Well, there would have to be some tests applied here, wouldn't you say? I'll leave it to your imagination and your ingenuity to pursue that little proposition. But I can offer you one test, a pretty rigorous test, that I apply to myself. It goes like this. As I look out and see the loss of humanity or lack of humanity flagrantly and massively displayed in human history, especially in the 20th and 21st centuries, and flagrantly displayed in current events and in the social behavior of human animals. As I look at that, I ask myself, well, how do I respond to that? What response does it elicit in me? And I ask myself the question, if I do not respond dramatically and existentially by some intervention against the loss of humanity in the world outside, then do I not exhibit my own loss of humanity in turn? Is it not evidence of the lack of humanity in you if you do not respond dramatically and existentially to the lack of humanity you see operating in the world? I'll leave you with that little proposition. And call your attention to another facet of scrutiny here. It's one thing to detect the lack of humanity or loss of humanity in human behavior. It is detectable through behavior. For instance, if you have the stomach to actually go and watch a documentary about what happened when the Jewish Bolsheviks hijacked the Russian Revolution and what ensued in the Stalinist era and the period of the gulags, or what unfolded in China when the ideological virus of Jewish Marxist communism spread through Asia, then you're going to see a manifest and irrefutable demonstration of insane and inhumane behavior. But that's easy enough to see. It's easy to see when people are acting inhumanely acting from a complete absence of human feeling, absence of humanity. But what allows you to detect the presence of humanity in the first place? I return you to the gaze of the child on the front page of the British newspaper. When you look at that photograph, when you look into the eyes of that child, of course not the real child's eyes, I would wish you to be so fortunate as to have that experience. And I dearly wish I could as well. But now, let's beware. Apply the Gnostic nuance here. You're simply looking into a photographic replication of the eyes of that child. Do you see humanity in that child's eyes? Or is humanity streaming from your eyes? Is there humanity in your look? Do you have the look of the Anthropos? Now, when I have said that not every single human animal, by nature of being born into the human species, carries humanity, this is what I mean. Humanity is an act and not a state. It is a way of looking rather than a quality to be seen. It is not an essence. It is a factor of our existence. And according to the cliché of existentialism, as expounded by Jean-Paul Sartre, existence precedes essence. So when I talk about the Anthropos and the quality of humanity, well, be very clear. I am not talking about an essence that is either present or lacking in a human animal. I am talking about a quality that comes into existence by the recognition of it. It exists in the look that recognizes it, and it returns that look of recognition. There is a dynamic at play, look to look, in the consciousness of the Anthropos. Now, you know very well, from a Gnostic and Sophianic point of view, how to define humanity, don't you? Sure, we can define humanity according to the Sophianic narrative in clear and explicit terms. Humanity is the sentient creature generated by two pleromic eons in the galactic center, the core of the galaxy where the solar system is located. Humanity is one strain of sentient life endowed with specific properties such as epinoia, metanoia, pronoia, dianoia. And in this composite of properties, this endowment, encoded into nucleic acid, the aeons generated, the two aeons, Selete and Sophia, generated by their dreaming power, the genomic plasm of the human species, and the entire pleromic company deposited it by projection in the molecular cloud of the Orion Nebula. That's the story. And when you know the story, we can define humanity according to its origin, according to its composition, according to the calibration of the genomic plasm, and so forth and so on. And then you can say, by continuation of the story, that the genomic plasm of the Anthropos spreads on mycelian filaments which carry the encased propagules of DNA to favorable planetary environments throughout the galaxy. Thus, the Sophianic narrative affirms that there are other strains of that original anthropic plasm living, propagating themselves and living on other planetary systems elsewhere in the galaxy. The story also informs us that this humanity, this version of the anthropic strain, which produced you and I, is unique because it inhabits a planetary environment in which the divine Sophia herself exists in material immanence, which is not true of the other planetary settings in which variations of the human strain are now, at this very moment, as I live and speak, existing and living and developing. So there you have it. In the syntax of the Sophianic vision story, you can say that humanity can be defined as the primary subject of the experiment unfolding on the planet Earth at this time. Why are we the primary subject? Because Sophia and Thelete generated the human genome for the purposes of observing how it would develop in previous, in various settings. They also observed it develop in 9 different world systems previous to this one. So I have introduced a convention in my extrapolation of the Gnostic mythology and the Gnostic cosmology, cosmogenesis, and anthropogenesis. I have introduced the convention of calling the current strain Anthropos 10 and the strain to emerge in the next kalpa, in the next day of this experiment, as Anthropos 11. Now, those of you who love this story and find it to be illuminating and incomparable, which it is, can accept the simple definition that humanity is the primary subject of the experiment unfolding in nature upon this planet, although that does not make humanity superior to any other sentient creatures who are engaged as well in the experiment, deeply engaged in the experiment with us. We are not superior to other animal species or even to insects and reptiles, but we are the exceptional factor in the experiment because we represent the highest possibility of co-creative interactivity with the wisdom goddess herself, she being both the source and setting of the experiment. Clear enough? How do you like all that, my friends? Well, I like it a lot. That's how I talk, isn't it? And you can talk that way as well. And when you talk that way, when you talk the Sophianic narrative, you're not mimicking me, or you're not playing a cult game with me in which I program you to think and speak in a formulaic manner. You're actually engaging your innate powers of imagination and language and vision to be a storyteller for the Anthropos itself. And each one of us has a role in that storytelling process. I'm merely the inceptor of the process because I recovered the myth. But even with all of the beauty and power that you and I feel by living this myth, And by remembering the story in its received elements and extrapolating it in its current and future elements, even with all the beauty and power and delight of that storytelling adventure, you still only have an abstract concept of Anthropos. It's just a concept of humanity within the framework of the story. Of course, needless to say, it's better than any other concept of humanity you'll find on this planet, because the narrative framework is superior. The concept of humanity as primary subject of the terrestrial experiment is a superior and incomparable concept, isn't it? But it's still just a concept. To have the look of the Anthropos, well, that implies and requires something more than a conceptual understanding of humanity. Even the conceptual, the best conceptual definition, does still not reach that experience of the look. You realize what the Anthropos is by looking at it. And the Anthropos is only realized in being seen. Existence precedes essence. When I say that being born as a human animal does not guarantee that you have humanity in you, I am speaking in a brutal existential manner that affirms that there is no predefined or preordained human essence in you, or me, or anyone. But the true humanity living in you exists in the recognition of it. It exists by recognition of it, from one human animal to another. So I have spoken before, I think on one or two occasions, about what I call the solidarity of recognition of the Anthropos. Using the word solidarity, I offer you a clue or allusion to Russian philosophy of the period of Soloviev, the end of the 19th century, leading into the 20th century. There were two great philosophers who died in August of 1900. Vladimir Soloviev, the Russian mystic, deeply inspired by the mystical figure of the divine Sophia, and Friedrich Nietzsche, who was notorious for his concept of the Übermensch, which I would define as the ultra-human of the truly, fully realized human potential, rather than as some master race, dominator figure. Both Soloviev and Nietzsche were deeply engaged with the problem left to us by the Teleste, namely, not just how to define the Anthropos, not just how to describe the Anthropos in the narrative framework of the Sophianic myth, but how to teach and transmit the true spirit of the Anthropos. And how is this done, I ask you? I propose that you consider the following. Let me begin with a short personal anecdote. I had the good fortune, around 1987 and 1988, to participate in one aspect of the recovery movement in the United States. That was also known as the 12-step movement. The original 12-step movement was, of course, Alcoholics Anonymous, founded by Bill Wilson. But some generation, a generation or so after AA was founded, it spawned a number of other 12-step recovery movements, such as Al-Anon and Adult Children of Alcoholics, and many, many others. Overeaters Anonymous, Gamblers Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, were all built on the same model. During those years, I had the good fortune to participate in ACA, which is understood to be Adult Children Anonymous. The peculiar factor in ACA was that it stood somewhat apart from the other 12-step programs. All of the other 12-step programs were related in one way or another to emotional dependencies or substance dependencies. Even CODA, which was Codependence Anonymous, was a response to codependency and emotional addiction. ACA was a group that attracted those adults such as myself who had the adult child syndrome. What is the adult child syndrome? Well, it's characterized or profiled in this way, simply that you are an individual who brings into later adult life the complexes and problems that you had in childhood which were not adequately treated. So the adult child has the unfulfilled needs of childhood, such as the need for attention, and carries those needs forward where they become neurotic and counterproductive behaviors in adulthood. So I was in ACA. You didn't have to be recovering from any substance abuse of any kind to be in ACA. And I remember once that I was in an ACA room off Cerritos Road in Santa Fe. And one of the members of the meeting came in carrying a book called The Drama of the Gifted Child by Alice Miller. To many of us at that time in that movement, Alice Miller was a paramount figure of influence. We widely discussed the work of Alice Miller, and she was often cited in these 12-step meetings, which, by the way, in case you don't know about them firsthand, were simply gatherings of people who shared their experiences without A, the benefit of a therapist, and B, without crosstalk. Crosstalk is the term that refers to one member of the meeting criticizing or analyzing another. There was no analysis of any kind conducted between members, no crosstalk. You could refer to the sharing of another person, but only by way of citing your own experience and the parallel with your own experience. So these meetings were a safe place to be. I always knew that I could go into an ACA room and spill my guts, as I did hundreds of times over 3 or 4 years, and never, ever have the slightest fear that I would be criticized or looked down upon or judged in any way for what I said. I can remember going back to, say, probably the fall of 1988, the tremendous impact of discovering Alice Miller. And the first book that I read by her was The Drama of the Gifted Child. This book came out in German in 1979 and has been widely read and translated in other languages, including English and French. Another book by Alice Miller that I would recommend if you would like to delve into her work would be The Untouched Key, which was published in German in 1988. Alice Miller was born on the 12th of January in 1923 with the sun in the empty space. She died on the 14th of April 2010 in Saint-Rémy-de-Provence in France. She is described as a Swiss psychologist of Polish Jewish origin. Well, how remarkable is that? Now, it so happens that Alice Miller is a great, great heroine of mine, and I hold her in very high regard as a figure who has shaped my education in the sense of humanity, such as I have any sense of humanity. Alongside Alice Miller, I place Sabina Spielrein, who has been described as a Russian Jew. But in my view, both Miller and Spielrein were not Jews by the definition that they lived by the Jewish ideology of the Old Testament or the Talmud or the Khazar Ashkenazi standard of political expediency or the protocols of the Elders of Zion, which are the four mutations of Jewish ethics. I would say that Alice Miller was Polish, period. And if she was Jewish or not, that was for her to say and for her to show by embracing the ideology of the Judaic faith. I do not believe that she embraced such ideology. The biography says that she was born in Poland into a Jewish family, that is to say, into a family of Poles who define themselves as Jews. It also says that she managed to escape the Jewish ghetto in 1939 and survived World War II in Warsaw under an assumed name. Then, in 1946, she fled to Switzerland and began her studies at the University of Basel. So, I hold in high regard these two women, one of Polish and the other of Russian extraction, and I don't consider them to be Jews because they did not, by definition, assume the way of life and perspective on life that comes in the programmation of Judaic religion. Remarkably, both these women have in common a dedication to children and child psychology. During her lifetime, and I believe to this day as well, Alice Miller was considered to be the foremost child advocate on the planet Earth. Sabina Spielrein, who was relatively unknown, and still remains relatively unknown, was a pioneer in child psychology and the study of autism. She consulted and taught Jean Piaget. She established the first school for special psychology for children in Russia during the Stalinist period. So both of my heroines have been dedicated to that luminous child who is the Anthropos. Dedicated, I should say, to educating the world in the recognition of that child. Now, Alice Miller's book, The Drama of the Gifted Child, contains two outstanding points. The first is that Alice Miller famously rejected the idea of mother love. She claimed that mother love is not given as a biological or instinctive endowment in the human animal. Therefore, according to Alice Miller, parents do not automatically love their children because they are born their children, nor do children automatically love the parents given to them by the roulette game of biological reproduction. So it was a huge thing for Alice Miller to challenge the concept of mother love. And it was a great taboo. And with that taboo, with the breaking of that taboo, and her clear repudiation of Freudian psychology and the Freudian treatment of infantile psychology, she drew her line in the sand. She established herself as an advocate of child psychology that would actually be beneficial to the child. Imagine that. The second point to be taken from the drama of the gifted child is supremely and centrally pertinent to the topic of this briefing. I'll never forget the moment when I read these words in her book. Alice Miller said that when adults gaze at children, more specifically at the infant in arms, a transaction occurs in the gaze, wordlessly. What is this transaction that occurs in a mother looking with her eyes into the eyes of the infant in her arms? Alice Miller said that the essential factor for every human being, I would say human animal, to be healthy as a human animal is self-love. And she famously stated that we acquire self-love from others before we can make it our own. And the way that it comes to us is by the gaze that is directed upon us. So Alice Miller said famously that all human infants need to acquire self-love as the core upon which they can develop character and personality in later life. You would think that self-love is some intrinsic property that comes from yourself and can only be accessed through yourself. But Alice Miller said, no, we acquire self-love through others who already have it and who transmit it to us by the way they look at us. I put it to you that we acquire humanity in the same way. Alice Miller also pointed out that when the child does not encounter self-love transmitted from a self-loving person into the child's eyes, when the acquisition of self-love in childhood does not occur, that the child acquires a syndrome which is called narcissistic deprivation. This term, narcissistic deprivation, comes uniquely from Alice Miller's work, and she applied it extensively. In French, it is called carence narcissiste. Narcissistic deprivation means that you have at the center of your awareness of being alive a black hole of need that can never be filled. Narcissistic deprivation is the wound that human animals carry by the lack of self-love, and I would add, by extension, by the lack of humanity. Humanity is transmitted in the gaze, in the look. And apart from that transmission, apart from that act, it does not exist as a stable and predetermined essence. Such is my view. Now, to bring this briefing around to its conclusion, the final 15 minutes, I'm going to do something that some of you really don't like. or I suspect that some of you don't like so much. And that is, I'm going to use a complicated Sanskrit word. And this word is spelled as follows. Pratyabhijnahardayam, which is pronounced Pratyabhijnahirdayam. Now, bear with me for a moment while I break down this word and make a swipe at translating what it means. Pratyabhijna consists of two words, the first of which, prati, means in Sanskrit the disclosure or appearance of something that seems to have been lost. And abhi, which is related to bija, means immediate. And jna, J-N-A, means to know. In fact, the Sanskrit root jna is cognate with the Greek root gno of gnosis, and which likewise is cognate with the three letters K-N-O, which are the first letters of the word know and knowledge in English. So the first part of this elaborate term refers to the immediate knowing of something that appears to have been missing. The last part of the term, hirdayam, is a variation on the Sanskrit word hirdaya, which means heart. But in Sanskrit, it is always used to refer to the seminal essence of some realization. For instance, the Prajna Paramita Hirdaya Sutra was called the Heart Sutra. Hirdaya means heart. Hirdaya means the heart of the matter, something that is known by getting to the heart of it. So, in summary, I would translate this word, Pratyabhijna Hirdayam, as recognition in the heart of self-knowing. Recognition in the heart of self-knowing. In fact, Pratyabhijna is commonly translated as recognition. This concept of recognition is central to a school of Asian philosophy known as Kashmiri Shaivism. You'll find that I've written about that here and there on metahistory.org, but in particular, if you go to the essay in Planetary Tantra entitled Divine Pulsation, The Origin and Impact of the Shakti Cluster, you'll find that there is a subsection on Kashmiri Shaivism. Suffice it to say that it is one of those Asian philosophies, which includes a method of self-realization, that purports to lead you to the ultimate root of consciousness. And the word recognition plays a central role in this philosophy and in this method, because it has been understood over many millennia by those mystics who followed this method, that when you recognize the innate nature of the universal consciousness behind the consciousness of everything in the universe, you recognize it as your own self. That is a Pratyabhijna moment, as it were. It's as if you forgot what your own face looked like. You had some weird type of amnesia. And you blanked out, and you couldn't recognize your own face. And then one day you stood in front of the mirror, and pow, you thought, wait, that's my face. That would be Pratyabhijna, the recognition of something that you thought was missing. I'm bringing this up without going into a huge digression on Kashmiri Shaivism, obviously, because in my mind, the concept of recognition obviously relates to the look of the Anthropos. How would that be so? Well, let me see if I can put it in a simple, elegant, and cogent way. What the premium Asian wisdom teachings say is that when you realize the ground awareness that is beholding itself within every other form of awareness in the universe, you immediately acquire that awareness by recognition of it. That is the meaning of the word recognition in the context of these ancient mystical teachings. That is the meaning of it in one sentence. And I think if you reflect on it, you'll find that that sentence has quite an impact. In the dynamic of that sentence, you see the dynamic trick, as it were. The trick of the universe, you could call it. When you realize the beholding power of the entire universe, which is the ground of everything manifesting in the universe, which is called Shiva, by your realization of it, you acquire it, and that is called recognition. And in the moment of acquiring it, you realize as well that you could never not have had it, and that it was never missing from your current normal and ordinary awareness, even though it appears to be. Such is the wonderful revelation of these non-dual teachings, which are held in common by Advaita Vedanta and Kashmiri Shaivism. I bring this up because I want to propose to you that that time-tried, timeless principle of self-realization of Asian mysticism also applies to the recognition of the Anthropos. You have the humanity of the Anthropos when you recognize it, because by recognition you acquire it. But the recognition is a shared recognition because it is the Anthropos. And the consciousness of the Anthropos is common between human animals who look at each other and see it in each other's eyes. But if it is not seen, do not suppose that it is there anyway. That is not how it is with the sense of the Anthropos. Because the Anthropos is a generated creature. That is how it is with the sense of Shiva, or the ultimate beholding presence. It is there whether you recognize it or not. But the Anthropos, the sense of humanity, comes into reality by the recognition of it, and by having it recognized in you. And so the look of the Anthropos is a two-way generation. That must be transacted among living human creatures in order for the Anthropos to live. And without that two-way recognition, then the Anthropos does not automatically live in the human species, and the human species may perish for lack of its humanity. And this is the situation the world faces today. In fact, I put on YouTube today to look at some of my subscriptions, and I saw a recommendation to a clip of a talk by Alex Jones. You know, Alex Jones presumes himself to be a great mind and a philosopher. And here is one of his 10-minute philosophical rants, and guess what it's entitled? the loss of humanity. Black Jaguar turns about in the empty space. The moment of war concerns the moment when humanity doesn't just lose the battle against the anti-human element in our midst, but it loses itself in the battle. This is a very dangerous moment, my friends. This is a moment for Kali to command. And as I speak to you now, actually the day after the 1st of January, as I've picked up this briefing the following day, I speak to you in the first day of the Kali shift of 2014. Now let's conclude by going back to the image on the front page of that British newspaper. Well, as I said already, bear in mind that you're not looking into the eyes of this child who would be standing in front of you physically in your presence. But try to imagine what you'd feel if that were so. I don't know how I could take it, really. I don't know how I could stand to look into the eyes of this child without surrendering to the impulse to worship and adore it. I don't think I could stand in the presence of this child and could bear its gaze upon me without cracking. When you realize that humanity arises co-emergently, to use the Buddhist term, where one gaze meets another, looking across the otherness and the space of difference between two human animals. When you realize that, I don't see how you can turn away from this child. I don't see how you can't stand up and say, yeah, the mystery girl is mine. She's my daughter. And there are hundreds of thousands of children like this on this planet. Millions. I remember over 20 years ago, I heard the statistic that there were over 10 million abandoned children in Brazil alone. The Earth is the planet of abandoned children. Why? Because it is the planet of the Anthropos looking for itself. So now, as we enter the year 2014, the first year of correction when the reset is done, it might be wise to carry forward the look of the Anthropos. It might be wise to remind yourself that humanity is not an ideal. It's not an essence that precedes existence. It's not some kind of spiritual quality that stands alone and autonomous, whether or not it is acknowledged, nurtured, protected, celebrated. On the contrary, it needs all of that and more, because it is not an essence and not an ideal. It is a connection. A connection made through the mere and simple act of looking. And in that connection between us, in that connection that flickers like a lambent evaporating flame, humanity is found, or lost. The fragility of being human is like the fragility of this mystery girl. Take a good long look at that. And as you do, bear in mind and be assured. Be assured that through the rage of Kali and through the wisdom of the planetary animal mother, the look of the Anthropos becomes a diamond gaze. And that diamond gaze is the assurance of survival. It is the look which is invincible. That diamond gaze in which humanity recognizes itself and holds that recognition, holds it between us, passes it from gaze to gaze. That look cannot be defeated, and it defeats every division and every illusion on this planet, including the illusion of compassion.